Several days later, the information was delivered. It arrived unceremoniously in a soiled manila folder, handed to me by a courier who had ridden through the dust and gas fumes on a motorbike. There was no note attached, nothing to explain where it had come from or why, but it was all there, everything I needed, and I never paid anyone for it. As I pored over the dozens of pages of boring numbers, I wondered why it had been such a big deal. Was there a logical reason for withholding these statistics? The only explanation that came to mind was the Egyptian fear of an Israeli airstrike, but I could not see how population projections could help Israel. They already possessed, I was certain, all the information they needed to guide their planes and missiles. Bombs did not care whether a specific suburb would increase by an additional 100,000 or 110,000 people during the next 20 years. Then I recalled Dr. Asim's words. I was an infidel dog. The Egyptians knew something that only a few of my countrymen comprehended. We used data, like the projections Dr. Asim had provided to me, for empire building. EHM economic reports were far better weapons than crusader swords had ever been. Israeli bombs served their purpose, delivering havoc, raining down fear, and compelling government officials to capitulate. But people like me were the real danger. We were the ones who took advantage of the havoc, channeled the fear, and made sure that those who capitulated honored their articles of surrender, and hopefully learned their lessons well enough to avoid future bombings. Ultimately, we had to be pampered because we sat at the top of the heap. Men like Dr. Asim had no choice but to give in or lose their jobs. And he detested me for it. Chapter 36. Iran. Highways and fortresses. I hopped around the globe a great deal in those days. Dr. Asim's words accompanied me. My emotions turned from defensive to angry, and then I arrived at the realization that he was a proud man who hailed from a proud culture and hated the knowledge that, like Cleopatra's courtiers, he had to bow to Caesar. I understood that in his place, I might have been even ruder. I was struck by the irony that my country might be Rome to modern Egypt, but at home we experienced our own tumult. I had grown up during an era of national self-examination. We had lived through a series of events that deeply impacted my generation. The Watts and Detroit riots, the standoff at Wounded Knee, marches by Cesar Chavez and his United Farm Workers, and multitudes of other, less publicized acts of rebellion by minorities in the United States. I equated these events with those of my ancestors who had experienced similar oppression at the hands of English masters. Impassioned indignation had led all of them to take up arms. Blacks, Indians, and Hispanics had been labeled as subversives by the corporatocracy, and my ancestors had been traitors to the British Empire builders. Yet, now young people looked up to the minority leaders as heroes, and those men and women who had defended their rights against foreign masters were our founders. And here I was, a man caught between worlds, on the one hand, sympathizing with the freedom fighters, on the other, serving the captains of empire. As if to emphasize my dilemma, I traveled to Iran many times. I worked for the Shah. We EHMs portrayed the Shah as a ruler determined to cultivate his country into the flower of civilization it had represented during the reigns of Darius and Alexander the Great, 3 centuries before Christ, a man who would employ his vast oil reserves, combined with the expertise of companies like Maine, to materialize dreams of grandeur. Somehow we managed to convince ourselves that from this transformation would rise a democratic, egalitarian society. Our strategy to offer the Shah's government as an alternative to those in Russia, Libya, China, Korea, Cuba, Panama, Nicaragua, and other nations where anti-Americanism was rampant, focused on the alleged facts that in 1962, the Shah broke up large private landholdings and turned them over to peasants. He and we then created his White Revolution, a program that appeared to inaugurate extensive socioeconomic reforms. I shudder now, looking back, because I know that in our hearts we understood that all this was really a whitewashed revolution. It was a subterfuge for boosting the Shah's power. On the surface, Iran was a model of Christian-Muslim cooperation. However, in actuality, it was a proxy for U.S. hegemony in the Middle East. It was exactly what Dr. Asim had feared for Egypt. It was also an outcome of the type George Rich wanted when he advocated controlling the Middle East and Africa for the sake of America's future generations. Maine's contractual assignments in Iran increased significantly after 1974. The push for oil had grown frenetic. The word was out. Bring OPEC into our fold. Make them servants to the empire. My job was critical. The planners and engineers depended on my forecasts of regional development to design electrical systems that would provide the huge amounts of energy needed to fuel the industrial, commercial, and military growth required to assure wealthy Iranians that they would prosper. Their happiness was the key to maintaining the Shah's rule and the steady flow of oil. "You'll fly from Tehran to Kerman," Bruno Zambadi, my boss at Maine, told me. "An oasis in the famous Dasht Elut, the high plateau desert where Alexander made his historic march. An oasis of secret delights. From there you'll drive through some of the most spectacular desert on this planet to Bandar Abbas. Today it's a sleepy fishing village. Tomorrow it will rival the Riviera." By then I knew Bruno was prone to hyperbole, but I had no idea. I joined two Maine engineers on a small plane from Tehran to Kerman. It was midsummer. Although late afternoon, the heat was stifling. The town appeared neglected by time and, except for a few children and old people loitering in the shadows, vacant. If the dust and squalor were hiding secret delights, they were certainly beyond my reach or imagination. Sweating profusely, we checked into the town's best hotel. The lobby was small, gloomy, and practically devoid of furniture. The young man behind the receptionist's counter was pleased to inform us that, yes, they served cold beer at the patio bar. Each of us had our own room, amazingly, with bathroom, and we agreed to meet at the bar in 30 minutes. The room was typically sparse, but delightfully clean. To my relief, it sported a window AC unit, very noisy but functioning. Although there was indeed a bathroom, I discovered that the toilet did not flush. Two faucets protruded next to it. The higher one turned on a tiny spigot above my head that I suppose served as a shower. The lower one could be used to fill a rusty bucket that allowed me to flush the toilet. I stripped down to take a shower standing in the tiny space between the toilet and the wall. There was no shower curtain. When I turned on the faucet, a paltry spray missed me but drenched the toilet. If I leaned over the porcelain bowl, I could dampen myself enough to work up a lather and rinse off. The only other indication that this contraption was supposed to perform the function of a shower was the hole in the floor at the opposite end of the bathroom through which the water eventually drained. I wonder when Bruno had last visited this oasis. Surprisingly refreshed after my shower, I made my way to the patio bar, four rust-flecked iron tables and a dozen chairs situated on a terrace that opened to an impressive view of the nearby desert. One of the engineers, Frank, was already seated there, three full beer glasses on the table in front of him. "Only one brand," he said. "I figured you'd take it." We waited 15 minutes. Then we decided that our companion must be napping. We toasted the next day's journey and took a drink. As we set our glasses down, James arrived. He shuffled across the terrace looking bedraggled. He was holding the shirt he had worn on the flight out. It was sopping, dripping wet. He slapped the shirt onto the table, plopped down in the empty seat, and drained his glass of beer. What happened? Frank asked. I had to take a crap, James replied. The toilet wouldn't flush. I saw that damn bucket and turned on the faucet. The wrong one. I got soaked by the shower. When we finally stopped laughing, Frank pointed out that the desert air would dry the shirt in no time. That's what I figured, said James. Otherwise, I'd never have carried it out here to this fancy bar. The next morning, we were picked up by two Iranians, a government engineer translator and a driver in a Jeep wagon. They took the front seat and the three of us crammed ourselves into the back seat, me, the youngest, in the middle, straddling the mound of the driveshaft. As we drove along the crude road that would transport us from the high central plateau desert down to the shores of the Persian Gulf, the Iranian engineer explained that we were following the route of ancient caravans. This desert has always been both a curse and a blessing, he said, craning to look at us. It protected my ancestors from enemies and made it almost impossible for them to cross their own country. Today it's more important than ever. You see, Dasht Elut separates Europe, Africa, and what you call the Middle East from Asia. It also offers a direct route between the Soviet Union and the Persian Gulf. Look at a map. You know that the Russians want to occupy us. This very road we travel, rough as it is today, would become a superhighway for their military. Right alongside, he pointed, they'd build a huge oil pipeline. The little town where we'll sleep tonight, Bandar Abbas, would become a communist fortress. Jets, missiles, nuclear subs, aircraft carriers, they'd control the world's most important oil routes. Frank, James, and I shot looks back and forth. Guess that sums it up, James observed. We got quite a job ahead of us. Don't feel pressured, though, my friends. All we have to do is save the world from communism. The key, the Iranian continued, is for us, you Americans and us Persians, to do it first. We must build that military highway, and we must turn Bandar Abbas into our own fortress. That's why we're here, said Frank. Always keep in mind, the engineer observed, that Iranians are not Arabs. We're Persians, Aryans. We're Muslims, but the Arabs threaten us. We're with you guys 100%. The desert was not the endless waves of sand Peter O'Toole had struggled through in Lawrence of Arabia. There was nothing monotonous about the mountains of red, purple, and russet that stretched for as far as the eye could see. To my mind, it was absolutely beautiful, as spectacular as Bruno had promised. And it was foreboding. I could not imagine caravans of hundreds of people and camels crossing it. Despite the Jeep's AC, there was no relief from the oppressive heat. We made a number of stops so the engineers could test the soil and other conditions that would impact the transmission line, pipeline, and highway. When we vacated the car, at first it seemed cooler, but then the sun bore down relentlessly. Once, we took a break for tea and dates at a tiny village that truly qualified as a desert oasis, a tranquil island in a hostile sea. Shortly after leaving the date oasis, the car filled with a terrible odor. "Something's burning!" Frank yelled. The driver pulled to the side of the road and slammed on the brake. "Everyone out!" the Iranian engineer commanded. The doors flew open and all the men leapt to the ground except me. I could not lift my feet from the floor. My legs felt paralyzed. "Hurry up!" James commanded. "What's wrong with you?" I had no idea. I strained with all my might, but my feet simply would not obey. Panicked, I slipped out of the loosely tied topsiders I was wearing. Thankfully, my feet responded. I pushed myself through the door and tumbled onto the desert floor. Cautiously, Frank peered back inside. Then he began to laugh. "The rubber soles of your shoes," he turned to me, "melted and are welded to the carpet over the drive shaft. I've seen engines overheat before, but this takes the cake." It required work, but eventually I was able to separate my topsiders from the burnt carpet and we continued on. We arrived in Bandar Abbas, just as the sun, was beginning to set. Chapter 37. Israel, America's Foot Soldier. Located on the Straits of Hormuz, opposite the Horn of the Arabian Peninsula, where the United Arab Emirates, Oman, Bahrain, and Qatar were created when the British withdrew in 1971, Bandar Abbas commands one of the world's most strategic corridors. It was once the headquarters of fierce pirates who marauded ships sailing out to the Arabian Sea. Today, much of the world's petroleum passes close to its shores. When we arrived, it was still a small, impoverished village, with an enormous modern hotel located right on the Gulf. A prerequisite to attracting the types of consultants who could transform this town into a state-of-the-art military-industrial center. The five of us were some of the hotel's first guests. We assembled for dinner to find that we and three waiters had the spacious restaurant to ourselves. "Come back in 5 years," the Iranian engineer said, "and you won't recognize this place. One way or another, it'll change. Either you'll do it, or the Russians will." After we broke up, I grabbed a cigar and went alone into the night. I headed for the water. A newly constructed wharf extended out over the shallow gulf, reaching perhaps a half mile from the shore. There was no moon, but the night sky was bright with stars. I wandered slowly out into the wharf. A breeze stirred the gulf. Despite the lit cigar, the stench of decaying fish permeated the air. Looking across the dark water, I wondered what was happening on the other side. I realized that I knew little about the countries that rimmed Saudi Arabia. About three-quarters of the way out, I stopped, halted by a jolt of fear. A strange red glow rose and fell in a slow arc at the end of the wharf. I stood still and watched it, telling myself I should scurry back to the hotel, but anchored there by a perverse curiosity. I took another step. As my eyes adjusted, the ghostly image of a man materialized. I raised my cigar. The red glow mirrored my action. He, too, was smoking. It seemed his cigar was mocking mine. I lowered my cigar. His followed. The longer I observed him, the more curious I became. My fear dissipated. Surely a thief would not have picked the end of a wharf to find his victim. Who was he? I immediately thought about the Russians. But what would one of them be doing here at this time of night? I continued, consciously altering my stride. I wanted to convey an impression of determination and strength. Perhaps 50 feet away from him, it struck me that he might be anxious about my presence, too. I slowed down. He coughed. I stopped. Then he spoke, in Farsi or Arabic, I was not sure which. "I don't understand," I said very slowly.
"American," he responded.
"You're American, aren't you? I can tell from the way you walk and your accent. My English is pretty good."
"Yes, I'm American."
"I'm Turkish," he said. "Like you, a visitor, a guest in this hotel. Please come join me."
I walked up to him. We shook hands. His name was Nassim. He smoked a cigarette, not a cigar.
"I'm a college history professor," he explained, "researching a book on old trade routes. I've traveled from Istanbul, following some of those routes. They brought me here."
We talked for a while about our impressions of Iran. He made no secret of his loathing for the Shah, the dictator king, as he called him. Up until this point, I had not heard anyone in this country criticize the Shah. I had, of course, read of an underground that wanted to overthrow him, but all the Iranians I knew worked for one of the branches of the Shah's government. This man was different. Obviously well-informed, he was not shy in expressing his beliefs. I suspected that he was pleased to have an audience. An American who was willing to listen to him must have been about the last thing he expected to encounter on the wharf. Perhaps it was the night, the place, or simply exhaustion from the journey. In any case, I found myself listening intently to Nassim's point of view.
"All of you are deceived by the dictator king," he said. "Well, not all. I'm certain your president knows the truth, and the other people who run your country know it too. That is, after all, their specialty. Deception. Your leaders hide their imperialism. Or try to, anyway. They hide the money they make, the things they do to corrupt people. They brag about helping the downtrodden, while they hide the fact that they protect the rich. He took a long drag on a cigarette. You are a country behind a mask.
Several times I felt that I should interrupt, that I needed to defend the United States, and by doing so justify myself, but instead I listened. Referring to the 1973 Yom Kippur War, he asked, "Why did Egypt and Syria strike at Israel? They felt they had no other options. Your people haven't a clue of the crimes the Israelis commit against Arabs, the threat they pose, or that it is really an American war. Israel is just your foot soldier. It wasn't enough that you stole Palestine, the land its people call Dar al-Islam, the eternal domain of Muslims, and handed it to the Jews. You had to keep taking more. You used your wealth to make the Jews think you were building them a homeland. You rub Muslim noses into the shit of history. You sing fancy songs about democracy. But we saw what you think of democracy right here in Iran when your CIA overthrew Mossadegh. Oh, Israel isn't about democracy or protecting a people victimized by Hitler. You torture, lie, and steal for oil." He placed the hand that held his cigarette, the right one, over his heart. "I feel for the Jews in Israel. Really, I do. I'm not Palestinian, so I can do that. I suppose I would kill them if it came to battle, if you tried to shove your borders into Turkey. But I also sympathize with them. They're like sheep sent before armies. Shields. You Americans are to blame. You encourage Jews to sacrifice their families while your corporations pump oil. Jews are your watchdogs. You give them nuclear warheads so they can keep us Muslims in our place. You fund their army. The Palestinians have no army, just a few patriots. They have no government, no land to live on. For you, Israel is all about domination, about controlling oil. For the Jews, it is a dream, one that will prove illusory. For Palestinians, it is their home, a home they've been forced to vacate. For Arabs, it is an enemy fortress built on Arab lands. For Muslims everywhere, it is an insult, a humiliation, a reason for us to hate you."